Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, it's Megan Mitchell from Agents of Change. Thanks for checking out my podcast. If you enjoy the content, please check out my ASWB test prep courses for the bachelor's, master's, and clinical exams. Each Agents of Change course includes more than 30 key topics that closely match the ASWB KSA content areas. Our content is great for both auditory and visual learners and includes video walkthroughs, supplemental materials, hundreds of practice questions, and twice monthly live study groups with me. You can learn more and get 10 free practice questions at agentsofchangeprep.com. Thank you for tuning in. We are bringing you today a social work month treat. We will be going through our three hardest ASWB practice mock questions. And this is specifically our three hardest questions from Agents of Change, exam number two. So if you are using Agents of Change, this will be those questions from the second exam. If you're not, here is a little preview of some of those questions that are very, very, very tricky and get people a little bit stuck. Before we jump into those three questions, though, I do want to say happy Social Work Month. We will be celebrating all month long with a lot of different surprises and fun things over on our social account. So check us out on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. We even have just now launched on TikTok. So if you're there, give us a follow and some likes. We have a lot of stuff still going through the end of the month, so check it out there. And also, if you are planning to purchase anything, definitely use our $10 off code and share it with anyone that may find this helpful. The code is SW2024, and it's for any of our products. So that could be the full program, that could be practice exams. Go ahead and check us out at agentsofchangeprep.com. But let's go ahead and jump in. This is just a quick rundown. You will need to know these three types of questions and how to approach them on the exam. There's three types for any of the different levels of the exam. So bachelor's, master's, and clinical. What differs is how many of these types of questions you will see. Recall is on the master's and clinical level. These are few and far between. These are questions that require you to remember a fact or a concept, and it's really just memorization for our recall. The next level is application questions. These are more tricky because not only do you need to recall the information, but you have to apply it to particularly a case scenario or a real life situation. So you are really taking that information that you already have and putting it into real life situations. And then the third type is the hardest type. We have reasoning questions. And these are the trickiest because you have to engage your critical thinking skills. They're difficult because not only do you need to recall, not only do you need to apply, but you have to synthesize the information. So there, it's not going to be very clear cut. You're weighing the pros and cons. There might be some gray area here. You might be having to look a little bit closer at the details that are given to you and problem solve. Sometimes ethical dilemmas or some things that are a little bit fuzzy might fall under the reasoning questions. So our first question that is one of the hardest ones is question number one here. A school social worker is working with a child who has a skin infection that has become progressively worse. The parents have not taken the child for medical treatment and are dismissive of the child's concerns. The child complains of pain and frequently cries due to discomfort. Which of the following actions is most appropriate for the social worker to take in this situation? A, consult with the school nurse and inform the family that further medical attention is necessary because the child is in pain and the condition continues to worsen. B, have the school nurse treat the skin while the child is at school. C, ask the family about their cultural and religious beliefs to determine if that affects their decision to access medical services. Or D, make a CPS referral for medical neglect. So if you are doing this in real time, you might want to pause it here and work through this question. And I will leave a few seconds here before we start breaking it down. Okay. This one is often tricky, and I will tell you which ones most people select. That is not the correct answer, but let's go ahead and do process of elimination. So we are a school social worker. So we know in a school, there are multiple players working alongside the child here. And we know that there is a nurse available because that is in some of our answer choices. So we don't have much information about how severe this is. It just says it's become progressively worse. We don't have a time frame here. We don't know what the skin infection is, but we know that the child has not gotten medical care and the child's crying due to discomfort. We also don't know the age of the child. So this is where things are a little bit gray area here. We don't know this information, and we do not want to make any assumptions. What would I immediately rule out here? If I were eliminating, I would rule out C. Ask the family about their cultural and religious beliefs to determine if that affects their decision to access medical services. Has nothing to do with what the question is asking. I do not see anywhere that even says that that is a concern. So that would be an assumption, assuming that there is a cultural religious belief that is preventing them. That is not addressing the problem. So C is out. What I would also rule out is B, have the school nurse treat the skin while the child is at school. This could get tricky depending on what the school nurse can and cannot treat. We don't know what the condition is. What are they treating with? What if the child needs antibiotics? What if the child needs care that cannot be provided by the school nurse outside of our scope to even do this, right? I would never say, nurse, can you treat this, right? We are not medical professionals. We're not making those calls. So we're down to A, consult with the school nurse, inform the family that further medical attention is needed, or D, make a CPS report for medical neglect. So this is where things get tricky. Do we have enough information yet to make a medical neglect call? I would argue no. So D would be ruled out. This is what most people choose. Most people choose make a CPS report for medical neglect, but that is too soon at this time, given the details that we have. So the correct answer here is A, consult with the school nurse and inform the family that further medical attention is necessary because the child is in pain and the condition continues to worsen. Why is this the best answer? Why is this a better answer than calling CPS? Looping in the nurse ensures that the proper experts in that area are going to be informed. We do not have medical knowledge, right? That is outside of our scope. So having the nurse step in is going to be really helpful because they have the medical knowledge. Additionally, by having the nurse come in and say, hey, your child's in pain, the condition's worsening, we think that it is necessary you get further treatment, that's going to engage the family and it provides a chance to educate the family. Like I said, we don't know what the skin infection is. We don't know how severe it is. We don't know the age of the child. Parents might not know. It might not even appear physically to look that bad, right? So we're not going to assume that they are not treating it because they don't want to. We need to consult with the nurse and have a conversation with the family. And it's important that we do this before making a CPS report because we want to make sure that they are given the opportunity to address it. Additionally, this is the most collaborative because we are consulting with the nurse, we're getting parents involved, and we are saying you must take them for further medical attention. It's kind of giving them the option, okay, we've assessed, get them medical attention, and that is where we're meeting them at this point. I would say if they still do not follow up on the recommendation, that would probably move into the warranting a CPS report case there. But as you can see, it's nuanced. We don't have enough information to know the severity, to know the age, to know what's going on, to know how long this has been going on for. So the best answer here is A. And here's the little rationale. The child is experiencing discomfort. The condition is worsening. We don't know how long this has been going on for. It is the responsibility of the social worker to ensure that the child receives the necessary medical attention. So consulting with the school nurse and informing the family about this need is the most appropriate way to address the child's needs and ensure their well-being. Question number two, this is what I would call a macro level question. The best way to establish support for the funding of a community development program is A, gaining support and approval from community leaders, B, establishing and mobilizing grassroots organizing and support, C, presenting data on similar programs with a high success rate, or D, presenting an evidence-based implementation plan. If you're doing this in real time, go ahead and pause it, answer this one, and we will go ahead and break this one down. How do you support funding for a community development program? Best way. Okay, let's go ahead and break this one down here. What I would do first is eliminate C, present data on similar programs with high success rates. That's great, but if people are not bought in, if we don't have the support of the community, why would they care what this data is, right? That might be down the line, but if you just come presenting, hey, here's the data, this worked in other places, but without the buy-in, it's not going to be successful. It's not the best way to do that. So C is out. D, presenting an evidence-based implementation plan. I don't know about you, but as a everyday person, I would zone out. I do not have the level of expertise to be motivated by an evidence-based implementation plan. If I have not even been engaged yet, I don't know why they're doing this. I don't know why it's important. So we are left with answer choices A, gaining support and approval from community leaders, or B, establishing and mobilizing grassroots organizing and support. They're very similar, but one casts a wider net than the other, which should help you make your decision. So the correct answer here is B, establishing and mobilizing grassroots organizing and support. The most common mistake people hear is they go for answer choice A, approval from community leaders. You would do that, but it's not the best way because part of engaging community leaders would be starting with the grassroots organizing and support because we want to cast a wide net. First, we want to say, hey, here's what we're planning to do. Let's get as many people in the community to support this. And then we would identify who those community leaders are to leverage. So grassroots organizing, this is a community organizing term. It's going to engage the community members who will directly benefit from this program. And when they're actively involved in advocating, knowing about this program, their voice as a whole is going to be really powerful. So we want to get on the ground, mobilizing those that this program is going to affect first and establish that because that is going to get more widespread support than just going to the community leaders. When we just go to the community leaders, we aren't including as many people as we could. So that is why this one's the best. B is best because it leverages the most social capital, which in the long run will probably be most helpful when we're trying to get funding, right? With funding, the more support you have, the better. So the other option A is not necessarily a bad option. It's just not the best option because it doesn't create the level of community buy-in and support that answer choice B does. Okay. And here we have this. When working with communities, it is important to work alongside the community members and have them become active participants in the community work. It's most likely to be funded when support and action are being taken by those who live and work in the community. Remember, we want the largest level of support we can and whom the issues directly affect. Okay. Question number three, the last one we will do today. And this is a diagnostic question. This would definitely more fall into a clinical diagnostic question. It's asking you for a DSM diagnosis. A social worker is treating a client whose roommates have expressed concern about recent changes in her behavior. Historically, the client reports low mood and social isolation, as well as a lack of appetite. However, over the past week, the client has experienced an increase in energy, staying up for 15 hours at a time to talk on the phone with a partner and getting little to no sleep. Based on these symptoms, which of the following is the most appropriate diagnosis for the client? A, major depressive disorder, B, bipolar 1 disorder, C, bipolar 2 disorder, or D, ADHD. So go ahead and pause this and go ahead and use the big key here. Use the clues that you have to come up with a diagnosis. Okay. What am I going to rule out here? I'm going to rule out major depressive disorder because while there is some of that low mood and social isolation, we are experiencing a high and a low. We're experiencing that social isolation, low mood, lack of appetite, and then we're getting this burst, increase in energy, 15 hours at a time, talking on the phone. So major depressive disorder is out. It might be a component of depressive symptoms, but that would not meet criteria for that. I'm also going to rule out ADHD. While it does sound like there's some increased hyperactivity, we don't have enough to know that it's impacting multiple functions throughout, you know, we don't have if we know if it's happening at work and school and with social peers, we don't have enough information to make an ADHD diagnosis here. And some of the low mood, social isolation, lack of appetite does not give us enough information at this time. So we're between bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. So here it's really crucial that you understand the subtleties that exist between the two. The correct answer here is answer C, bipolar 2 disorder. And I will explain why. And that is because this client is experiencing hypomania. It's very important that you know what the difference between manic episodes are and hypomania. So what would make this bipolar 2 versus bipolar 1? Bipolar 1 is typically when a person has at least one full-blown manic episode, which in this diagnostic criteria usually means that it is so severe that some level of intervention is needed. This is generally hospitalization. So they're typically severe. They can significantly impair daily functioning and may require hospitalization because the person is generally a harm to themselves or others. We don't have that knowledge here that this person staying up 15 hours at a time is a danger to themselves or others or would require hospitalization at this time. Why is this bipolar 2? So bipolar 2, same symptoms as bipolar 1, but you're seeing the shifting from high to low with a hypomanic episode. So we have the low mood, social isolation and lack of appetite. But the high here is, and I just want to say here, in hypomania, we should see the increase in symptoms and they should be for at least 4 days. We have a week here, so we have that. Usually hypomanic episodes are noticeable changes, but not significant or severe enough to cause impairment in social or occupational functioning to the point it would require increased level of care. So given this, bipolar 2 is a more fitting diagnosis than bipolar 1 due to the severity of the symptoms we're seeing when the client is having those heightened symptoms. So that one's a little bit tricky. People get tripped up. So really make sure that you know the difference between bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. So here's our rationale for this one. Bipolar 2 disorder is often characterized by those periods of depressed mood and then the periods of hypomania. Less severe than mania, it's not going to cause hospitalization. It's not going to cause severe higher level of care needed. The client's reported low mood and social isolation are consistent with the depressed phase of bipolar disorder. And the recent changes in behavior, including an increase in energy, staying up for 15 hours at a time, and getting little to no sleep, are consistent with what we would see for hypomanic episodes. So hopefully that provided you some clarity. Those are tricky questions, and I hope that it helped me. I hope that it helped by me telling you what the most common answer choices selected were and why those are incorrect. So if you're looking for more ASWB study content, check us out. We have something for everyone. We have tons of free resources. We're doing a lot for Social Work Month, as mentioned before. If you have any questions, please check us out at agentsofchangeprep@gmail.com. We'd be more than happy to help you. And remember, you got this. Wherever you are on your studying journey, thank you for trusting in Agents of Change.